your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
The Gathering. The supernatural world can be a dark, intimidating, and scary place. We gather to shine light on the mysterious and misunderstood aspects of the paranormal world. We bring to the table years of experience as mediums, healing channels, and paranormal investigators.
We share true stories from our experiences to dispel fear where we can and help you discover the amazing layers that make up the paranormal world. You are invited to gather around the metaphysical table with us and discuss the worlds of the unseen on The Gathering Radio Show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Gathering. This is Stephanie.
And this is Heidi. We're here on the Para-X Network once again on Tuesday evening. So excited to be here and excited to be through the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yes. It was very fun.
It was fun, but it's another one checked off the list.
Yep.
Moving through the holidays. Mm-hmm. It's just there's so much food.
There's so much food.
And it's like it's nice when the food stops.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, that much food.
Yeah.
Because I have to eat it.
I know.
If it's there, I will eat it.
See, here's the thing. So I did not host the holiday this year, so I only had to bring blueberry dessert. So that was good.
Nice.
And I did have some leftovers because my sister, of course, cooks her own turkey for leftovers. And so we stopped by there and she gave me a thing of turkey. But otherwise, you know, I didn't have like a refrigerator full of stuff. So that's good.
That's good.
So I didn't get sick of it this year, you know?
I didn't get sick of it, but I had a fridge full of stuff and I ate it.
Yeah. But it was fun. And the thing is, the cool thing is that, so we ate a lot on Thanksgiving, but then the next day we were out in the woods hiking. So that was good.
Yeah.
You know, kind of hiked some of it off, I feel.
That was we had a good day on Friday. And that was actually really interesting.
It was very interesting. So, yeah, so we went and we were out squatching in the woods and...
as opposed to in your backyard.
Well, we could do it in the backyard. You know, I have enough trees.
Where else would we go? Yeah.
You know, you might be out there. I don't know. but yeah, we had some interesting things happen out there.
Yeah, we posted it, didn't we? We posted it on our page.
We posted a couple things, and I do have to finish my blog because I am writing a blog post about it. So we'll just let it go from there. But we did have some interesting this stick structure. What we can say is that our infamous stick structure quadrant that we always have to look at when we're out that way has changed. That has gone through some changes, and some of the stick structures that were there last time we were there and have always been there have disappeared somehow. In the last two, I think it's been a couple of months since we were there.
Were we there in October? I don't think so. I think we took hunting month. No, I mean,
it was right before Paracon. Yeah.
So it's been about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And because we wanted to take most of the big gun hunting out.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to be out there for that.
No. And so, we ran across two archer hunters or bow hunters when we were out there on Friday. So that's why we have to wear our crazy orange outfits.
Yeah.
And I know people say, you know, Bigfoot might not be turned out or might be, we'll see you a mile away and probably won't come near you. But the thing is, we don't want to be shot by some crazy hunter out there. And we know that that's happened a lot in Minnesota this year.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know so much if that's true or not. We'll have to ask our guest that question tonight. But
does hunter orange scare off Bigfoot? We'll have to find out.
Maybe it would just make the women more fetching to him. I don't know.
Maybe it would be attractive to Bigfoot, and they would be drawn in by the cool color.
By the cool of us, yeah. I don't know.
I'm sure that's it. So, yeah, it was cool. It was interesting to see the stick structure quadrant changed so much for no, like, we couldn't see why.
No.
I mean, we couldn't see anything other than, I don't know. It'll be interesting to go back.
Yeah. So I will be writing a blog post. So just, you know, watch our Facebook page, Squatcher's Facebook page, and you'll see it, and then you can read it. And we'll include pictures too, of course. But Heidi, we have a wonderful guest on our show tonight.
We do. This is a guest that we first interviewed at Paracon this year, and we posted the audio of that the following week, and we have him back this week to talk about cryptids, and we have Nick Redfern on with us. Hi, Nick.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for being here tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Yes, absolutely. We enjoyed talking with you at Paracon last month, and we love the topic of cryptids, and I know that's one of the areas of expertise that you are in, and we just would we wanted to have you back and talk a little bit more about what you're doing and cryptids, and we have some questions for you about some Minnesota cryptids, too, that we're going to throw at you today.
Okay.
So...
Well, what's up?
Oh, I was just going to say, what are you, because we haven't talked to you for 6 weeks, so what are you currently up to? What are you working on?
Well, I've actually got a brand new book out right now. It's not a cryptozoology book, it's a UFO book, and it's called Top Secret Alien Abduction Files, and it's all about what government agencies know about the alien abduction phenomenon, which is not something you really hear too much about, but I've got a lot of information and also files that came out through the Freedom of Information Act showing very clearly that government agencies are interested and concerned by, you know, this whole alien abduction issue. So it's sort of like a new twist and a new approach on the phenomenon of abductions. And it's only been out about just a couple of weeks. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how people react to, you know, this sort of new angle on the whole phenomenon.
Yeah, it's. I'm looking at your book right now. I'm on Amazon, and I see it's here. You said the Freedom of Information Act. Is that how you get most of your information for the books? Then.
Well, it depends, I guess, on the, you know, the subject and the style of the book. I mean, certainly when you're dealing with things like UFOs. I mean, I do use the Freedom of Information Act quite a bit to, you know, to get files declassified from military agencies and things like that. But of course, you know, if you're doing things like Bigfoot or a Chupacabra expedition, that's sort of a very different approach, you know, where you're just sort of in the woods or the mountains or wherever. And so those kind of books, I sort of write those in sort of like a first-hand road trip style, you know, and like a diary journal style where people can kind of, you know, follow me as I do the expedition. So I tend to write in those two very different styles, one which is more historical, you know, the factors, if you're reading sort of like, you know, a news story, that kind of thing. And then I said the other one is I like to sort of write those sort of road trip journal type books where people get a feel of, you know, they're on the expedition with you, that kind of thing.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at your biography here on Amazon, and you cover a wide variety of subjects. You go all over the place.
Well, I do. Yeah, I mean, there's a few that I don't. I mean, things like ghosts and haunted houses, I'm just not really that interested. I mean, I don't know why, I'm just not, you know, it's, and there's plenty of people who do that kind of stuff anyway, so there's no real point me kind of jumping in sort of half-hearted, not really know what I'm doing, you know. So I tend to stay away from that angle, only because, like I said, you know, it's just not something that really kind of intrigues me. But I guess my two main areas are cryptozoology and the UFO subjects. And of the two, I would say cryptozoology, because just going back to what I just said, you know, I enjoy sort of hitting the road and going on expeditions and road trips and looking for these things, you know, rather than just, you know, do all your research on the internet.
Yeah, I think that's, because the internet is, I mean, who knows what kind of information you're getting.
I mean, you'll find a lot of information on the internet about Nessie or Bigfoot, but you're not literally going to find them on the internet. You know, if you want to find Nessie, you've got to go to Loch Ness.
Right.
You want to find the Skunk Ape, you've got to go to Florida. And it's no good saying, well, these things can't exist because I haven't seen them. Well, you got to go looking for them, dude, you know.
Yes, exactly. I think the internet's helpful to get the ball rolling.
Yes.
You know, that might be good for locations or witnesses or people that you can contact or whatever. But
yeah, definitely for like the history side of things, you know, you find a lot of good articles and data going back years where you can get a lot of material. But I think in saying that, you know, if you're going to find these things, you really have to go looking for them. And I'm sure you know, sometimes you can hit on something. You might have a couple of months where it's just totally cold, you know, and but you don't have to sort of get, you know, sort of downhearted or whatever. I just feel you just got to keep digging. And I guess that sort of went back to when I was a little kid, and my parents took me on a week's holiday to Scotland. We spent a day at Loch Ness, and my dad told me the story of the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, when you're sort of 5, 6 years old, whatever I was, you know, standing on the shore of this huge lake and being told by your dad that there's monsters in there, you know, it sort of stays with you. You know, you never forget that kind of thing. And I still have a few memories of that trip to Loch Ness, the first time I went there. And that sort of really got me interested, I suppose. And then as I got 11, 12, maybe something like that, I started, you know, reading books by people like Brad Steiger and John Keel and, you know, just these sort of atmospheric tales of monsters. You know, that kind of classic thing when you're like, you're 9, 10, 11 with your flashlight in the bedroom, you know, when you should sleep.
Oh, yeah.
Get ready for school the next day, you know.
Yeah.
So it really was kind of like that. And fortunately, I've never really lost that fascination or excitement for the subject, you know. I still feel, you know, when I get on an expedition, get in the car and turn the ignition on and get, I just get fired up, you know, as much as I did however many years ago.
So do you have one specific cryptid that would be nearest and dearest to your heart? Like if you went, like if there was one that you could really dig in and investigate or go after or whatever, do you have one? Can you narrow it down?
Yeah, I mean, well, I can probably nail it down to two, which I guess is almost there. One of the things I have a lot of sort of good memories of and fun, and also, but a lot of data surfaced as well. I've been a lot of expeditions to Puerto Rico looking for the original chupacabra. Now, you know, a lot of people, if you mention the chupacabra today, they think of like these skinny, hairless dogs. But that angle has really only come into play in the US for about 10, 15 years. Before that, people were just talking about the original Puerto Rican chupacabra. And I've been to Puerto Rico on many occasions now over the course of about 13 or 14 years. And collectively, I must run to like a couple of months altogether. I've been out there several months altogether. And, you know, come across a lot of cool and interesting stories from ranchers, department people from the Department of Civil Defense, police officers, veterinarians, all who've had some sort of inputs, and eyewitnesses, obviously. And, you know, having spent a lot of time out there, particularly in the El Yunque rainforest, which is where a lot of the reports surfaced, you know, people sort of, you know, gain your trust and they open up. And I've got a huge number of reports of the chupacabra around in and around Puerto Rico. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's a real, very strange animal on Puerto Rico. I don't know what it is, but there's, you know, a large body of evidence that there's something. Now, typically people describe it not like the hairless dog in the US, but like a bipedal animal walking on two legs, and has sort of this like a row of spikes down its head and neck, and about the size of a chimpanzee, but completely hairless and very fast running, quite very violent. And
how tall?
I've been there on many occasions, and you know, there's clearly something. And you know, I've explored many of the cave systems where people claim to have seen these creatures lurking in there. So, you know, there's a fascinating angle to all this. And I actually wrote a book about this a few years ago called Chupacabra Road Trip, which last month was just re-released by a new company, and so it's sort of illustrated, you know, with a lot of all the expedition pictures, where so again people can get an image, you know, and an idea in the head of what it was really like.
So how? So you said it's on two legs, or standing up on two legs instead of four. So how tall is something like this, approximately?
Mm-hmm. They're not actually that tall. They, I mean, if you think of something like a chimpanzee, which a chimpanzee, you know, isn't that big, isn't that tall, and its body mass isn't that big, but they're incredibly strong. You know, they'll literally tear your arm off. You know, they're extremely powerful and dangerous animals, particularly when they become adults. You know, it's okay when they're little, you know, little youngsters, 6 months old, you just hold them in your hands, that's fine, you know, but you don't want to mess around with a, you know, an angry adult chimpanzee. But that's kind of what they're like. That's the analogy, you know, in terms of size, speed, temperaments, if you like. And a lot of people have been sort of very terrified in their presence, you know, where they're sort of like snarling and growling at the people, and they're just petrified and, you know, paralyzed with fear. Now, there aren't, fortunately, many reports of attacks on people, but every time I've been to Puerto Rico, I have heard rumors of people allegedly killed by these creatures and how the authorities have hidden the story, etc. Now, you know, on the one hand, people might say, well, that's sort of like a classic conspiracy story, you know, like Roswell or something, where, you know, it's a friend of a friend of a friend type story. And I think some of them could be. But in saying that, there are a few really weird stories that do go down that pathway where, you know, there are claims of, like, a cover-up to prevent the public from getting panicky of, you know, the people may have been killed by these creatures. And but every time I've been there, I've heard a significant number of theories, but they sort of boil down to three or four very popular theories. One is the idea that it's some sort of alien, extraterrestrial type creature. Then you have the theory, some people think, interestingly enough, because they describe it as having these huge bat-like wings, some people actually think, could it be some, could there be some sort of like large mutant type bat? Then you have the theory that some people on the island suspect is a real one, namely like sort of genetic experiments, classified experiments, that sort of thing. And then you have people who think it's sort of like a supernatural creature rather than a flesh and blood animal. So there's a lot of interesting theories, which makes the whole investigation intriguing as well. And I like Puerto Rico a lot. You know, I've thought about moving there. You know, I like it over there. And there's, you know, you have the old San Juan, which is the old part of the city, which hasn't really changed much since, you know, when pirates were sort of pulling up, you know, in their ships.
Very cool.
Yeah, really. I mean, you've actually got the old castles there and the fortresses where they would sort of fight off, you know, the enemy ships, you know, and things like that. So it has that sort of atmosphere to it, and it's sort of with this huge rainforest and, you know, the woods, etc. It is really is a sort of perfect place for a predatory creature to hide out.
Interesting.
Wow. And so you talk about that there are that what they call the same animal in the States, but they look different. So what is the difference between the Puerto Rican version and the United States version?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, because people do sometimes get confused. Now, what happened was the original Chupacabra stories and the name surfaced in 1995. That's when it all began. But it didn't begin in the United States till 2004, when, particularly in South Texas, people started to report sightings and even killings of these large, hairless animals, which look like sort of giant rats, if you look at some of the early photographs, and they're very scrawny, etc., etc. And one or two of them were actually killed, shot and killed, and when the bodies were autopsied, they were found to have coyote DNA. There was no doubt about that. But there's some weird angles to this, which suggests a certain pocket of these creatures, which began in Texas, are somehow mutating. And I'll explain what I mean by that. A number of researchers and veterinarians have said, well, these are just hairless coyotes with mange. But if you look at the bodies, which I've done close up, it actually doesn't seem to be mange. Now, for people who don't know, mange is a condition which causes an animal to lose significant amounts of hair. But it's rarely ever 100% hairless. You know, it's in patches,
right.
And it causes a lot of irritation and itching. So the animals scratch themselves to the point where they bleed because they're in so much irritation. Mm-hmm. And then infection sets in and they die. Or they get seriously ill. But with these animals, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of the scratching or the itching or the infection, and they're sort of almost 100% hairless. Also, they have these weird pouches on their back legs. Their front, their jaws, I should say, the top jaw has this significant overbite where the jaws should actually be sort of together, you know, they should be uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a good friend of mine, Ken Gerhard, I don't know if you know Ken.
I've heard of him. I've not met him.
Okay, well, Ken lives down in San Antonio, so he's in the ideal area to look into these cases. And Ken has found that where there's been clusters of these creatures seen, they're actually also seen in the area of coal-burning plants. Now, coal-burning plants give off us something called sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide is what's known as a mutagen, like mercury. If it gets into the bloodstream of like a pregnant woman or a pregnant animal, it can cause massive DNA damage to a person or to an animal, and it can cause severe mutated changes in the creature. And because there are clusters of these creatures, these hairless coyotes, which don't look any more like coyotes, Ken suspects that it may well be down to these mutagens actually creating like a DNA alteration in these animals. So we're actually seeing potentially a developing physical change in these coyotes into something very, very different, and which has become known as like the U.S. chupacabra.
Wow.
Oh.
I never heard that.
No, I didn't either. It's quite fascinating, actually.
It's an interesting theory that goes a long way to explaining why we weren't seeing them 20 or 30 years ago. Why is it just now? And, you know, if you look up mercury, you know, plus DNA damage, you'll see how badly mutagens can change people, like babies and animals, you know, terrible mutations, but they often manage to cope with it. And that's one of the interesting things that I think is relevant here, that these animals are changing, but they're doing it in a way which, in a very odd situation, they're actually coping with it and dealing with it.
Wow. I'm, like, totally thinking about this now.
I know, me too. We're pretty
like,
quiet.
Okay, I've got to speak now.
Our eyeballs are kind of rolling around down here.
Interesting. I'm like,
it is
very
interesting.
Now, don't I? Okay.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, another example of a mutagen, which people may have heard of, during the Vietnam War was what was called Agent Orange, which was like a basically like a weapon against the North Vietnamese troops. And Agent Orange was one of the early mutagens that demonstrated how, you know, animals could be altered. Another example, in Minnesota, of all places, back in the 1990s, I don't know if you know this story, but there was a wide range of frogs that were being found mutated in Minnesota pools and lakes and rivers.
Yeah,
and when that was looked into, that was like 99% sure that this was down to mutagens, and they were being born with like extra limbs or a third eye or just one eye. And although they looked really weird, they were coping with it fine. It wasn't sort of, it was killing them. It wasn't poisoning them. It was just altering their appearance and even, you know, their number of limbs and things like that. So you know, I think Ken could actually be onto something with all that.
Wow. That's fascinating.
And I have a clarifying question. Mike in our chat room is asking, of the chupacabra, when it runs, is it running on two legs or does it go down to four or does it switch back and forth?
Well, that's a good question, because the original ones in Puerto Rico were sort of running a high speed on four limbs, but people said that when it was sort of, you just saw them, it were bound away on two limbs. Now, what's interesting with the US ones is although they look like regular coyotes, they haven't changed that much, there are a number of cases where people have seen them sort of stand up on their back limbs and bounce along on the back limbs as well. And that's one other thing I forgot to mention, is that their front limbs are actually really, really small in some cases. Now, I did an expedition with Fox News, about a local Fox News team, about 8 years ago, 8-9 years ago in Oklahoma, where there have been reports. And there was a schoolboy there half the school had seen this creature. It was lurking around the school in a little town called Tecumseh. But there was a kid at the school named Ryan Craighead, and he managed to get a photograph of this creature. Now, if you Google Ryan Craighead, Craighead's one word, and then chupacabra, you'll see the picture that Ryan took, and you'll see how the creature really is like on two-thirds on back limbs, and with a pair of ridiculously stupid short limbs, make it look very odd. And that's a genuine photograph of what some of these things look like when...
Oh, my gosh. Sort
of, did you see the picture?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. I'll post it on our...
Well, that's the picture. That picture where you can see it, like, it's on its back legs, its front limbs almost look as if they've, you know, they've been chopped off, but they haven't. Their front limbs are often very small, so they have like this weird kind of bouncing along kangaroo type movement. And that one was out there for weeks in that area, and some of the kids even fed it, you know, that's why it didn't go away. But, yeah, that's a classic example of how some of these American chupacabras, as they become known, as how they are now not even walking or running like a regular coyote. They literally are sort of bouncing along in like a slightly sideways fashion in, you know, kind of... The best way to describe it, you know, if you're in the swimming pool and you kind of bounce along on your feet, that's how they kind of do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's way cool, right? I can't believe there's actually a picture here.
That's so weird.
And he does have little short legs. It almost looks like a
Tyrannosaurus.
Yeah, I was just going to say a T-Rex.
Yeah, it's a little Tyrannosaurus.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
I posted it on our Facebook page.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's weird and cool.
It is very weird and cool, all in the same
way. It is weird, but as I said, the interesting thing is, it's not sort of handicapping them. It's like they're changing. Mm-hmm. But they're absorbing the changes into their everyday life and, you know, progressive generations to where they're quite comfortable with it. You know, it's not anything, it's not like a physical handicap to them. It's just an alteration, but one that works for them.
Yeah, that's wild. That is wild. So I think we're going to take a break right now. We're going to do a commercial break. And that was your first, you said you could only narrow it down to two. Right? Chupacabra was your first one. We're going to have to find out the second one when we come back.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll be right back. Stay tuned at the Para for the gathering at the Para X.
Yeah. We're on the gathering on the Para X network.
Hi, this is Barry Fitzgerald from GHI, and you're listening to the Para X Radio Network.
Demons. Vampires. Werewolves. Skin. This and more. Sunday nights at midnight on the Staring Into the Abyss radio show. Come, get lost with us.
What happens to a ghost when their home is torn down? No one thinks of the disembodied when they rip down old buildings, dig up cemeteries, and build clean, unhauntable condos. Every year, hundreds of spirits are driven out of their own haunts by the careless living to exist alone with no one to scare. At Para-X Radio, our hosts feel the plight of these evicted disembodied, and we're reaching out to you to please open your heart to one of these lost souls, such as the ghost soldier of the General Wayne Inn or the abandoned spirit cat of Benjamin Rush. So please, please, let a little spooky into your life. Won't you open your house to a ghost without a home?
Para-X.
It is the secret of the world that all things subsist and do not die, but only retire a little from sight and afterwards return again. Nothing is dead. People find themselves dead and endure the mock funerals and mournful obituaries. And there they stand, looking out the window, sound and well, in some new and strange disguise. This secret must be told to the world, and they must tell it. Because they're not dead, we know this, and we'll prove it. So join Mike and Dave every Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for the Odyssey Files. Only on Para-X.
Welcome back, everyone, here to The Gathering on the Para-X Network, and we have Nick Redfern joining us tonight, who is a cryptozoologist, amongst other things, and we have been talking about the Chupacabra, which is his one of two top cryptids, mm-hmm. or fields of study, I should say, creatures of study, however mm-hmm. we want to put it, and it was fascinating hearing about the different types of Chupacabra.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the picture, I did post the picture on our Facebook page and in the chat room. It's weird looking and kind of cool. Yeah,
it is cool.
And I've looked for Chupacabra whenever I go somewhere that there's supposed to be sightings. I'm on the lookout. I'm always hunting around for Chupacabra because I think that would be really cool. So, Nick, we are wondering, number two of your top all-time favorite fields of study and or cryptid, what is your second one?
Well, it might be a bit predictable for some people, but I have to say Mothman. I've been to Mothman. Point Pleasant, Virginia, where Mothman.
Yay.
Yeah. On many occasions, four or five occasions now. And I just find the whole thing kind of fascinating. I'm not even sure if Mothman should even be in the category of cryptozoology or if it should be sort of like a paranormal or a supernatural category. I'm not sure because it kind of straddles both, you know, and but just the fact that, you know, you have Mothman there back in the 60s at the same time there was a bunch of weird UFO activity, you had the tragedy of the collapse of the Silver Bridge in town, which drowned 46 people, the creepy weird looking men in black prowling around town, and just the whole story, you know, it's got like something out of like a gothic horror novel, you know, and I think it was, that's one that really, as a kid, you know, when I was like 11 or 12, I read John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies, you know, and that one was sort of, when you're that age, it was like, holy whatever, you know. And that sort of really got me into it, you know, just this sort of fiery, red-eyed creature that was like half human and half gargoyle and half pterodactyl or whatever, you know, and then, as I said, you know, you had the real Men in Black, which is nothing like the movie version, where they're sort of like pale-faced vampires, you know, in black and prowling around town after midnight and knocking on people's doors and threatening them. The whole thing, you know, is just strange and sinister, and but it's interesting when you go out there even today. You know, if you go to the old TNT area, as it was known, where there, a lot of the original sightings occurred back in 66 and 67. And the reason why it was called the TNT area is because back in the Second World War, when we were fighting the Germans, the US military created a plant to create and store TNT, in dynamite, you know, to send out to help the troops. And they stored it in a lot of these round buildings that have become known as like igloos, huge buildings. And most of them are still there, but they're all overgrown and covered in like vines and moss and grass. And, you know, the trees have sort of, in some cases, even broken through the concrete. And it kind of looks like, you know, 10 years into The Walking Dead, you know, like the apocalypse.
Nice.
That's really how it looks. And in other words, it's very much like... a very, very sort of superstitious almost and sinister looking area, even today, sort of more than 50 years after the Mothman sightings even began. And to go around at night, you can really understand how people, you know, would sort of get terrified, I guess, by sightings of that creature in the same area as well. And I think it's like all those different strands to the story which sort of fascinate me in terms of, you know, was Mothman the cause of the crash of the collapse of the bridge and the death of the people, or was it some sort of warning entity that warns when disasters are about to loom, you know? And so lots of angles with Mothman, which I think, you know, why so many people have investigated it, and, you know, there's dozens of books on the subject of Mothman, because there really is so much to say, you know.
Mm-hmm. What's your take on it, on Mothman? Where do you think he falls into those options?
I believe people saw this creature, you know, this sort of fiery, like I said, fiery-eyed, flying humanoid. But, as I said, I'm not sure it's even a cryptozoological creature. I mean, if we're going to sort of look at it scientifically and down-to-earth fashion, I would put in cryptozoology, like Bigfoot, lake monsters, sea serpents, things like that. You know, the Yeti, mm-hmm. and the Chinese equivalent, the Yeren, and the Australian version, the Yowie, and like Orang Pendek in Sumatra. But when it comes to Mothman, I guess it's become part of cryptozoology because it looks like a strange creature. But if you look at all the different angles, there's so much sort of supernatural stuff attached to it. I'm not entirely sure that, you know, that calling it a cryptozoological creature is the correct thing. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not something where it's got to be sort of laid down in stone, you know, it is mm-hmm. this or it isn't that or whatever. You know, right. We're always going to be able to debate on it. But I think, I don't view it as a traditional cryptozoological creature, put it that way, as I do, you know, something like Nessie or a sea serpent or whatever.
Do you think it has a physical form or not?
Well, that's an interesting question because some people have described it as like quite literally like a flying humanoid, like, you know, like humanoid figure with his huge wings, kind of like if you ever seen the Jeepers Creepers movies, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Which kind of, you know, some people describe the Mothman as looking just like that, like a human figure with these giant bat wings. But other people said they saw what looked like a giant bird. Others said they saw something that looked more like a pterodactyl. So I sometimes wonder if maybe it really isn't like a physical creature. Maybe it is some sort of weird supernatural shapeshifter. Because the idea that there could be a flying humanoid, a pterodactyl-type thing, and a huge bird-like animal, all different ones and all in Point Pleasant, that's just not possible, you know.
Right.
You could not have that happen. So, you know, the whole idea of sort of shape-shifting supernatural things, I find it kind of intriguing, you know, if they're not physical in the way we understand it, maybe they can take on different appearances according to, maybe they even rip it kind of your own fears out of your own subconscious, you know.
Yeah.
They appear as in your worst nightmare. I think that's sort of an interesting theory as well.
Yeah, that could be. That's interesting.
So Mike in the chat room is asking, could the Mothman be showing up at disasters looking for injured and dead victims to harvest somehow, do you think?
I'm not sure, you know, I mean, the harvest angle, I'd never really sort of thought about that before. I mean, there's no doubt, though, that there have been cases where these sort of flying humanoid type things, which have all pretty much become known as Mothman. You know, if you see a strange flying humanoid, people say you saw Mothman, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's exactly the same one. But in 2017, there were a lot of sightings of things very similar to Mothman in the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there were literally dozens and dozens of reports.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, but what's interesting, but also quite disturbing, is that at the same time that people in Chicago were seeing this sort of flying humanoid thing, there was also like a spate of weird nightmares that people started reporting in Chicago, where they had these nightmares of like a nuclear attack on Chicago, and seeing this like gigantic mushroom cloud and like this, you know, wall of fire like 300 feet high, you know, just destroying everything. And what's intriguing is that this was at the same time when you had North Korea, you know, shouting that they would soon have a nuclear weapon which could reach Seattle or Chicago. Those were the two cities you know, that North Korea was talking about. So it's interesting, but interesting in a disturbing way, that you had North Korea, you know, boasting about this and that, and then you had the Mothman creatures seen there, and then you had all these people having these really weird nightmares. And I actually have two entire chapters on that in the new abduction book, the Top Secret Alien Abduction Files book, because a number of those people who had these sort of like nuclear nightmares, as I call them, were abductees as well. So, you know, that's another angle where back in 67, we had the collapse of the bridge and Mothman's presence, and today in 2017, 50 years later, we had Mothman sightings again, and people having these sort of terrifying dreams of nuclear war and so on. Whether that's a coincidence, I don't know. But, I mean, if it is just a coincidence, it's a pretty startling one. You know?
Yeah, for sure. That is really cool. I didn't know about those dreams about the nuclear stuff.
No, but that's interesting.
Yeah, and it sure ties in with...
If you look up Chicago and Mothman, you'll find 2017, you'll find a ton of stories. But also, if you look up like Chicago Mothman nuclear nightmare, you'll find several articles that I've written. And as I said, there's two full chapters about it in the new book.
Cool.
And it is really, really weird and creepy, you know, people having these extremely vivid images all across the city of like...
Wow.
Just massive destruction, you know, just everything's gone and everybody's gone, you know.
Wild. It reminds me of that. Remember that movie that was out in the early 80s when it was such a cold war between U.S. and Russia and we were always worried that they were going to bomb us with the nuclear bomb? I can't remember. The Day After was the name of that movie.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing it. And for days after, I would look at the sky.
We had a show in England which sort of scared everybody to pieces, in probably in the same way, you know, the Day After did in the US. And in the UK, they did like an hour and a half show about a nuclear attack on the UK. And it was based around how the effects on two families in the north of England. It was called Threads. And the title came from how quickly in a nuclear war, the threads of society would all just collapse, you know. And, and it was pointing out all this stuff about, you know, all these... like at school, you know, just hide under the desk for half an hour or whatever and you'll be okay. You know, they were showing the reality was that, it's almost unbelievable that the destruction that would be, you know, sort of like a 90% wipeout of everybody, you know, and the 10% who are left are sort of irradiated and psychologically just destroyed, you know, and the idea you can just hide under the cellar for an hour or two and come out and everything will be fine, like it's ridiculous, you know. People don't really wouldn't want to know what it would be really like, you know.
It would be bad. So
and
Nick,
on,
as
on a jolly note,
what?
Yeah, we'll move on from that topic.
We'll move on from that now. We wanted to ask. We wanted to ask you because you know we're cryptid researchers too, and although we focus mostly on Sasquatch, we do look for other cryptids, and here's the reason why. Not only are we interested in the whole field of cryptozoology, but when we are in different parts of the state, we do these things called Squatch Chats. So we get locals together and they tell us their stories about Bigfoot. But almost always there are people that come and tell us about different cryptids that they've seen. And there are a couple of really intriguing ones that I've never heard from anywhere before. And I just want to know if you've heard of any of the stories of any of these creatures. One of them... This man told us about that he saw it was up in the woods up there in northern Minnesota, and it was a bird. They thought it was just a bird about the size of an owl. But when this bird's head turned around to look at them, he had the face of a human.
Have you ever heard anything like that?
I've not heard of anything exactly like that, but I have heard of people saying they've saw, like, abnormally large owls. There's actually a famous case from the UK called Owlman in the southwest of England, which is like the Mothman, but it's sort of feathery rather than like a leathery wing type creature. But I've got a lot of stories of people claiming to have seen, like, owl-type creatures, which are way bigger than any owl could ever be. You know, he's sort of talking like a 6-foot body and a like a 13 to 14 foot wingspan.
Oh,
it's, you know, there's nothing
is.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in the, you know, the historical history, if you like, of owls like that. But there are a lot of reports along those lines, and also, as weird as it sounds, you can find all across the US reports of what eerily sound like surviving pterodactyls. You know, there's dozens and dozens of those stories where people have seen something that they swore was a pterodactyl, you know, a pterosaur. So, again, it's hard to explain these kind of cases when people see them sometimes in built-up areas, and you would think, surely we'd catch them, you know, if they've got, I mean, how big would their nests have to be?
It's fascinating, and I'm not saying it was an owl. You know, what I meant was it's about that size of an owl, or like a smaller hawk or something.
Yeah, the only thing I've ever come across with something with like a human-type face was actually an old newspaper story that somebody gave me a couple of years ago, and I'll try and find the cutting for you and scan it and send it over.
Awesome.
It was a report of like a wolf, or like a large dog-like animal, which had like a really weird human-looking face, you know, like the eyes and the nose and everything. And, you know, people just sort of froze at the sight of it. And, you know, so, but I'll see if I can dig that out and send it along.
Well, it's, you know, it's such a fascinating story. And the person who told us about this had also seen, you know, he's very intuitive also. So he also sees paranormal things like ghosts and stuff, but he also told us about, you know, he's seen the dog man up in this area too, and it is a remote area in northern Minnesota, so surely if there's going to be a place where you find these creatures, that's probably it. But the bird with the human face is what really got me. I'm like, that is so wild. What would you even do if you saw something like that? Scream, I think.
I mean, it kind of sounds a little bit almost like a gargoyle, you know, which has sort of vaguely human appearance, but they're winged as well. But what I have found is that sometimes, you know, people who've seen one strange creature, like the one that your source talked about, but then also seen the dog man, you know, I do sometimes think that some people who might be sort of particularly psychically kind of attuned, they may have the ability to, you know, see things that some of us aren't able to see, you know, and that may be like a good thing or a curse to them, you know. But I think I think a case can be made that some people do seem to have more like an intuitive ability than others do. And, you know, there may be things around us that most of us never see, and others, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, they do see them. You know, I think that's a possibility.
Well, so we have that. So we have the human face bird. And another something that was just, these stories were told to us last summer, so just a few months ago, actually, when we were up north, is that, have you ever heard of dragon-like creatures in northern Minnesota? I don't know if they're anywhere else, but in a specific locale up in northern Minnesota, he told us about these creatures that they stand 3 feet at the shoulders, and they're pretty much like dragons, and they mate in the month of May, and they're on these rivers in northern Minnesota, and they almost sounded like they made moo sounds, like a cow, like when during mating season. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
I've actually not heard of anything directly like that, and not from Minnesota. But what I would say is that some of these pterodactyl reports, you know, I mean, pterodactyls, you know, we're not birds. They were like they were flying reptiles.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you look at some of the artwork and recreations of pterodactyls, pterosaurs, excuse me, they do kind of, I guess, you know, they vaguely look like what you'd expect a dragon to look like, you know, these sort of leather wings with claws and a long beak and teeth, you know, very dangerous predatory creatures, you know, wingspans of like 30 feet in some cases. They were huge, some of them. That's the closest I could think of, you know, in terms of, I guess, what you could think of closest to, you know, like a mythical dragon. But other than that, I think, you know, that's about the closest. Now, I guess when you think of dragons, you know, in terms of like a reptilian appearance, I mean, there are a lot of reports of reptilian-type creatures. A lot of people don't know this, but the classic 1950s movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, the producer and writer of that story was inspired to write it because he actually went to South America and heard tales of these sort of reptilian people. And that's what inspired him to write the story that turned into The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And back in 1988, there were a spate of sightings of a creature that became known as the Lizard Man. And not quite a dragon, but, you know, it was sort of like a strange, almost like mythical lizard-type creature.
Well, the Lizard Man was one of our favorite topics last year, wasn't it, the Lizard Man?
Yeah.
That's a strange one, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. So, yeah, so we're on the field all the time, and, you know, we hear these stories, and so we, you know, we love to look for them ourselves, because, of course, why wouldn't you if you're in the area and they're telling us these crazy stories? But it's always fun for us because we have all this exposure to all of you really cool cryptozoologists who are also out in the field a lot to ask, have you ever heard of anything like this, and what do you know, and tell you about our stories, you know, that we've heard from people here. But those are two of the weird ones. And as you know, when we talk about lake monsters, Minnesota has those too, right? So we have Lake Pepin, which is home to Pepe the lake monster, which is very intriguing and interesting. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who live along the lake who have seen this creature. And I've actually seen a picture of what appears to be like a, it looks like the Nessie would look like to me. And also, I've heard that there is one up in Leech Lake, which is a lake in northern Minnesota, which the person who told that to me said they will never go out on that lake again because they were scared to death. And this kind of is the same familiar story, right? These people that have seen these creatures out in the water typically a lot of times have seen them when they've been out on a boat or a canoe or something. And it's like they say, we're never going out on that lake again because it terrifies them.
You do get that, you know, where people think they got a Loch Ness, you know, and occasionally people see something, but they go there all exciting. When they see something really weird and close up, it sort of freaks them out, you know, and it sort of, I guess it affects their sort of daily beliefs, you know, the idea that, wow, monsters are real and I saw one, you know, and you do find that sudden situation where the excitement is sort of replaced by just fear and terror, you know.
Oh, yes. Well, that's fascinating. And now when you were here at Paracon, did people did anyone tell you their stories from Minnesota? I'm just curious.
I actually got a few interesting, not from Minnesota. I did get some interesting Men in Black stories and things like that. But, no, I don't think I actually got any Minnesota stories at all, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I kind of think those stories come to us when we're actually out at different locations. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we have what we call Squatch Chats, and we have them at local establishments like coffee shops or even bars, and people come in, and what's interesting to me is that, you know, we have like big burly guys, hunters, that you would never think would tell you a story about a cryptid or Bigfoot or any of it, and they come and they are dead serious and they tell us these stories and they come with their pictures and a map and they tell us where they've seen these things. So it's really quite fascinating, I have to say, you know. And of course we all write down all the notes and say, okay, we're going to look for this. Unfortunately, there's just not enough time in the day to look for everything.
I know.
Absolutely. Right. Our day job like to. I think people like to approach researchers and investigators really to try and, you know, have some sort of sense of relief that they're not stupid or not crazy or not having hallucinations, you know, and they realize when they realise people are going to take them seriously, I think then they open up more. I think it's very often the fear of ridicule that makes a lot of people not say anything, you know, but, and they don't realise that so many other people are in the same boat. They very often don't want to talk about it for fear of being laughed at, so they shut up until they realise, they watch a show and they're like, whoa, that's exactly what I saw, you know, and then they kind of open up a little bit more then.
Well, exactly. And a lot of the stories, Nick, that we hear, because it seems like whenever we're out in the field, many times it's on, you know, Native American reservations here in the state of Minnesota, and they've kind of just taken us in. And, you know, they tell us these stories and, you know, they're totally serious, and they tell us, you know, how this relates to their legends and, like, you know, Gitche Sabe, who is Bigfoot. And, you know, it's very heartwarming to us to be trusted with this information, I got to say, you know, and they just must feel comfortable with us to tell us these things, you know, and tell us where they've seen them and go look for them. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating research, to be sure. Heidi is waving her arms here because it's 8:56, so we only have 4 minutes left.
I'm the official timekeeper.
Yes. So is there anything, do you have a website? Is there a place where people can find you?
I have a blog, which I update regularly. If you just Google Nick Redfern, you'll actually see my blog is the first thing that pops up. It's called World of Whatever, and it has links to all my latest articles and books and research that I'm doing, and photographs from, you know, recent expeditions. For example, there's a bunch of photographs from when I went to the Mothman Festival back in September. So I try and, you know, sort of variate it between what I'm doing work-wise and articles with expeditions and things like that. And people can reach me there, and people can also reach me at Facebook as well. If you type my name in, there are actually quite a few Nick Redferns, but I think mine pops up at the top. So if people ever want to chat or they want to share a story, if they want some advice on something they've seen, you know, I'm always happy and pleased to chat to people. So.
Perfect. And then also, I just want to let everybody know about your book one more time on Amazon. I see it on Amazon anyway. It's called Top Secret Alien Abduction Files, What the Government Doesn't Want You to Know. And that, you said, has been out just a couple of weeks, so brand new.
Yeah, a couple of weeks. And as I said, it's got two chapters on the whole Mothman nuclear nightmare angle.
I think that's interesting.
Oh, awesome. Because it links with abductions.
So. Very cool.
Yeah, I'm going to order it. It sounds like a really good book, Nick, so I'm excited to read it.
Yeah, thank you.
And
it was great having you as a
guest.
Yes. Thank you.
Will you come back sometime?
Yeah, I'll be happy to, yeah. Whenever you want me on, just give me a shout and I'll be there.
Because we could talk for three more hours on this stuff, so
absolutely.
An hour is not enough.
No.
Anyway, yeah, so thank you so much, and have a nice holiday season, and have fun searching whatever you're.
All right,
you're
too, guys, and same too. Have a happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, right. Everyone, for listening, and we will be back next week on The Gathering, same time, same place. We'd like to thank Sarge, our phenomenal producer, and of course the Para X Network for hosting our show,
and all of the listeners, because it wouldn't be anything without you. So thank you.
Yes, thanks.
And
so
those
much.
In the chat room. For your great questions, and we'll be back next week.
Bye, everyone.
Have a good night.